Welcome everyone to Art of Advisory. Today's episode is Scoping and Pricing the Unknown. And scoping and pricing the unknown is actually kind of an advanced topic on most people's journeys through value pricing and transitioning to value-added services. And the reason why I wanted to add some context to that, because I want to just real quick reiterate what my background is and what Kirk's background is in a quick 1 minute infomercial, just to give you an idea of where each of us is coming from in terms of how we look at unknowns. And unknowns are a concept that everybody has to deal with when it comes to professional services. So I'm an accounting professional that has been transitioning to value pricing the last 4 years or so. And basically what that means is I'm changing my mindset to be completely, driven. That's going to be edited. To be completely focused and driven to adding value up front to the client, identifying what that value is and being able to price it accordingly so I can do the work with a whole bunch of enthusiasm and accuracy and wanting to do it as good as possible and customer-centric focused so I can feel that I'm getting my money's worth, right? Because I'm giving it my all and I'm identifying what the client needs. And that's value pricing in a nutshell. I mean, there's a whole bunch of explanations we can get into in terms of how is it more profitable for us, the professional, how the client gets a fixed price versus an hourly price. But that's basically been my journey. And I met Kirk in person about 3 years ago, but I've known him for about 5 years because I've been following his podcast called The Art of Value, which is actually a very similar podcast, but his is extremely centric around pricing and options. And that's really where Kirk's domain of expertise comes about. So by joining forces, I bring some of my background in terms of how I've done with my journey through value-added services in accounting and how I've been adapting some of the stuff I learned from Kirk and Ron Baker and some of the other value pricing gurus out there in this transition. So Kirk, would you mind giving us a quick infomercial about your journey into value pricing? Because we're going to go really, really deep into scoping the unknown. So Kirk, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm so tempted just to inquire further about your mindset. I want to hear more about that. Don't edit that out. That was good. That woke me up. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that was before I discovered value. Now it's a mindset, but before that it was something else.
Yeah. Contrast a mindset with the mindset. I'm going to see how many times during the show I can say that. That's going to be fun. No, seriously, you're right. You mentioned you're an accountant who is transitioning to value pricing. I am a IT software professional who has transitioned to value pricing. Been practicing value pricing since late 2009 and have gone through the journey of what is it like to go from hourly billing to value pricing? What does it take to first get new customers on board, next transition existing customers? How does that affect pretty much everything in your business? And as you accurately stated, it is a mindset shift. Now, once you've made that mindset shift, you still have to deal with the unknown. It's interesting. A lot of the questions I get when I teach on value pricing deal with essentially how do you deal with the lack of certainty or how do you deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with the unknown? Now, honestly, you have to deal with the unknown regardless of your business model. The difference is when you are pricing by the hour, and it's actually not pricing, it's billing, because billing's done after the fact, pricing's done in advance. But when you are billing, you are transferring all the risk to the customer. So first of all, that seems unfair to me because the professional should be better at helping mitigate risk in their chosen profession, because while the customer may only visit with an accountant once a month, you as an accountant visit with customers every day and you've been doing it year over year and constantly honing your craft. So you're the expert. So you should actually be able to take on the same risk the customer does, but to do it with a lot lower risk. Second, because the risk is higher for the customer, they're actually willing to pay you more to take on that risk. So let's just kind of, you know, the elephant in the room. Wait, the customer is willing to pay you more to do something that is less risky to you. Yes, they are. And so that's what I hope we'll unpack during this episode.
Right. And every party in every deal has both unknowns, which is the future. Nobody knows the future. Now, you know, people can extrapolate based on the history and reputation of the person, you know, how things are going to go about. People can generally partially control the engagement with engagement letters and fixed price agreements or just, you know, service contracts, whatever is the legal vehicle that you're using to have a formal agreement of what the scope is going to be, right? So you could create some guardrails around it. But I've never had an engagement, whether it was really well documented, a customer that we love and respect each other dearly, that goes exactly 100% as planned. You know, by definition, life is just one big unknown. And by definition, business is taking risk. So both parties are taking risks by stepping into the unknown, but we're leveraging each other's reputation, skill set, experience to hope that, you know, at the end, the exchange of money for a professional service, whether it has to be accounting or IT consulting or database programming or business advisory, whatever the service may be, there's a hope in both sides that you both are walking into it knowing exactly what is going to happen. But the reality is no one really knows. So you have to take into account that and use that as a catalyst to not get stuck with, well, the only way to mitigate the risk is pricing by the hour. Because Kirk, isn't that the ultimate excuse we have? Well, I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm going to charge by the hour. That's what every single person says when it comes to pricing. Now, we don't want to spend too much time talking about value pricing because that's a topic, you know, maybe for another podcast to go deep into. But we want to talk about pricing. Now, pricing by definition is set, right? We set the price. Like you go to the supermarket, there's a can of beans, it's 89 cents. That's a price. Okay, you don't go in the supermarket and see, well, there's the idea of beans, and then there's the idea of the potential outcome of you eating beans, and then we'll give you a price. It doesn't work like that. It's price up front. Now, services are really, really based on another human being's capacity, another human being's output, another human being's effectiveness, efficiency, another human being's understanding, right? Because we're dealing with a professional service. And because of that, it's not as straightforward as buying a good itself. So what most professionals resort to, and I don't know if most is the right word, but a whole bunch of professionals resort to is just giving an hourly rate or just giving an they call it hourly price, but it's not hourly price. They get giving an hourly rate. That way, if the unknown ends up being that we spend an extra 20 hours, we charge more for it. Or if the unknown means we were able to solve it pretty quickly in 5 hours, we only charge for 5 hours. And that is a concept that has worked. And I would argue to say that it has worked well in one way, shape, or form. But I don't think it is how we shape the future of our profession. And it is not the way we shape the future of professional services. So with that, Kirk, let's talk about that very issue, the risk of the unknown and using the hourly rate as a way to mitigate it. What do you think about that? Is there a better response to that? Is there a way to ease the pain of the folks that think that the hourly rate is the only way to mitigate the unknown?
Well, it sounds like to me you're trying to pick a fight on this episode, because I'm going to take issue with the statement that hourly billing has worked and worked well. I think it sucks. The idea that it works well is an illusion. And it's an illusion, and I was once under the illusion. So before it sounds like I'm kind of trashing on everybody else, I have been there, done that, come to see the light. You know, it kind of sounds like sometimes we talk about value pricing, that it is almost a religion of sense. It definitely is a mindset. And so in the idea that, yes, we subscribe to a certain set of principles that affect the way we conduct business and the way we interact with customers, yeah, I would agree that it is definitely a mindset, which some people might call, you know, a business religion, I guess. But it is it is, I think, a more enlightened way of working with customers. Again, the biggest problem, or one of the, I have several problems. I don't know if I can tell you which one's the biggest, but one of the biggest problems that I have with hourly billing is just the idea of how it manages risk. It really doesn't. It, you know, basically it just transfers all the risk to the customer. And the irony is, customers think that by paying for something by the hour that they somehow have some kind of control, which is just ironic, because in professional services, really what we're selling is the end result. Okay. We're not selling the service we provide. We're selling the end result the customer can achieve by utilizing our service as a means to get to that result. We're really focused on the end outcome. And when you're billing by the hour, the customer has no control. I mean, the only control they have, I guess, really is after they get the invoice, if they're unhappy, they won't pay it, which, by the way, comes up a lot. I mean, how many of us who have billed by the hour have not had to take the phone call from the customer who calls and says, why did you spend so much time on this? By the way, it's irrelevant how much time as a professional you spend on this or that to the customer. Why? Because ultimately what they want is the result. The reason they're nitpicking the hours typically is because we haven't achieved the result yet. They're feeling the pressure of the risk of the operating in an hourly business model at that point, because they don't know how long it's going to take. It's already gone farther than they feel like it should have. Therefore, this sensor inside them, their intuition's going off, say, hey, I think the value equation's out of alignment here. I think, I feel like, you know, the cost is going up. I still don't have the value, because ultimately in professional services, usually the value is not possible to achieve it until the end of the service or the majority of it has been completed. So anyway, I could just keep kind of going off on that tangent, it's the whole idea of risk. And so let me just kind of summarize by saying hourly billing has this perception to the customer that it is safe, and it is not, for the reasons I've outlined. And now, as professional service providers, we like it, or have liked it in the past, for the exact reason we realize, even some of us consciously, that it transfers risk to the customer, and we're okay with that. In fact, lawyers got very comfortable with the idea of billing by the hour for that very reason, because particularly in litigation, as litigation got more complex, they couldn't predict things. And so they said, let's just transfer the risk to the customer. So again, there is this whole idea of risk. And there's risk, by the way, regardless of your business model. I actually think value pricing does two things. One, it manages risk better, because as a professional, you have to manage the scope. You don't have to manage the scope, or you're not as incentivized to manage the scope with and for the customer when you're billing by the hour. Because why? Well, there's a profit incentive. There's a money incentive to let the scope creep and to let the scope grow. So and I had a point number two, but I'm going to hit pause and allow you to react to some of this.
So for the record, I don't want to pick a fight. When I said that it has worked well, I didn't mean to say that it works well. So when I said it has worked well, is that many folks have built a livelihood around billing by the hour. And many customers see that as the standard. Like I recently went to a project in which I scoped the job out. It's a small factory in Miami. We walked the entire factory. I talked to the CEO. I talked to the controller. They told me everything that they wanted. And I laid it out on paper. I spent 4 hours building a proposal, explaining, you know, what my observation was, what the end results are, all the things that can go wrong, all the things that can go right, step by step, how long I think each stage is going to take me, and by when, more or less, I'll be able to turn in the final work. I mean, everything was spelled out, no hourly fees, nothing in it, with one flat fee and a value guarantee. So I actually told them that the amount is $24,000, you know, $12,000 is due up front, and the other $12,000, they can actually pay nothing or pay the whole thing or adjust to whatever they want if they're not satisfied with the work. I mean, what better type of engagement could that be? They came back and said, well, how many hours? You know, the customer said that. The customer came back to me and said that. So I agree that most customers don't care about the time, and they, what they really want is, okay, this is what you're going to deliver, guarantee the result, here's the price. I'll be able to triangulate that and figure out whether this is what I want or not. But it's been so many years in the making that there's still a, you know, you still have to fight against, in some cases, against just customers asking you for your hourly rate or how many hours it is. So I am by no means arguing that hourly rates or hourly billing works well. I'm saying it has worked to an extent well to some folks, although I am vehemently against it, just like you. So in that case, we won't take the fight. But let's switch to scoping, because if we could spend the whole hour talking about pricing, but I think that pricing comes. So it's funny, pricing and scoping are hand in hand, but when you think of them together, we get too deep into price theory, I believe. So let's park pricing and let's assume that pricing works itself out once we understand scoping. So scoping, to my understanding, I'm not an expert in scoping, but scoping, to my understanding, is trying to get a really, really good assessment of what the client ultimately wants, right? So that's where we price the value. But scoping, it's also very much about all the things that could potentially go wrong. And by wrong, I just mean unknown. It means I have to spend the whole weekend, you know, catching up and entering data into their customer list or vendor list, so by Monday they can go live, right? And I have to, you know, miss my, you know, a friend's wedding or something because I have to spend all weekend doing it. That's the unknown. That's what people are afraid of. Or maybe I have to reshift two of my employees to work on this project, on Friday full time because the client, you know, screwed something up in the back end and imported, you know, the vendors wrong with the wrong addresses, and somebody has to come in and clean it up because otherwise I couldn't move forward and do, my opening balance import or whatever it is that we're going to do. So that's the unknown that no one knows what's going to happen. The customer doesn't know what's going to happen. The service provider doesn't know what's going to happen. However, people always buy from experienced people, and experience means you've been there and done that. And if you have enough experience, you know, you know, at least from statistics, you know, what are all the possible things that could go wrong? So scoping is about discovering all the potential things that can go wrong from multiple factors. One, the customer's fault, and like we spoke about, you know, whose fault it is and that sort of thing on the last episode, right? We talked about that. So it could be the customer's fault. It could be your fault, right? Your lack of creativity or inventiveness or foresight or even just specific technical skills on the matter that caused something to go wrong, or maybe something just, you know, environmental, like something that you can't help, right? Like we're waiting for a permit to be able to move forward on a construction job. All those things are the unknowns of business. And if you've only been in business for, let's say, 6 months, you really don't know what the unknowns can be. And that's why people typically don't want to hire newbies, right? Because you can't, you know, technically, you know, foresee what can go wrong. And customers are much more interested on you foreseeing what can go wrong than just being blindly optimistic about what can go right and using an hourly rate, again, because we're assuming that we're going to be done in 20 hours to scope out a job. So I think scoping is a lot more about, you know, predicting is the wrong word, but, you know, try to get as close as possible to predicting all the possible things that can go wrong and have a plan in place to fix them on the fly and budget your time and resources to be able to fix those things on the fly. That way, when the customer gets the end result, all those turbulences, all those risks, all those unknowns become baked in the cake of the engagement. And to me, that's what scoping is. As I would love to understand from your perspective, Kirk, what is scoping and what kind of mindset you have to have, mindset you have to have when doing scoping?
You almost said it yourself, didn't you? You almost said it again. Wow. Okay. We may have invented a new term here. We may have to create the Mind Shit Conference. Told you I was going to try to get it in as much as I could.
Kirk, seriously, from mind shit to mindset.
That's, yes, that's there we go. The Mindset Conference. All right. Enough joking around. So I just want to go on record as saying hourly billing sucks, and any excuse or reason that it might be partially good, I can knock those down. So I just want to go on record as saying that and be clear. So that being said, you know, you mentioned that when we talk about scoping, pricing comes up, and you said, yeah, but we really don't want to get into pricing it. We're not going to get into pricing theory, pricing techniques, and all that, although you can't completely ignore it. And so we will get into, you know, because options are one of the most useful tools to help with managing risk. But let's back up to scoping. First of all, I want to point out that scoping is not the most important thing with the customer. What is the most important thing is the result they're going to achieve. And that's, again, why the contrast of the two business models is so important. Because when you're billing by the hour, the focus is on the inputs, okay? And so you instinctively, because your business models focus on inputs for both you and the customer, you both realize that either consciously or unconsciously. So then you begin to look at scope, because scope, as you said, drives how many hours. And if that's ultimately how we're going to, quote, price this thing, build this thing, whatever it is, then it makes sense that we would kind of go down that rabbit hole. But if you back up and you focus on the end result, which is what true value pricing does, it says, okay, what is the result the customer is going to achieve? And then what is a fair price to the provider to help the customer achieve that result? Or even put the customer in a position to achieve that result, because in a lot of professional consulting, we can't achieve the result for the customer. All we can do is put them in a better position to achieve the result. So a lot of times we're pricing not achieving the result, but we're pricing helping put the customer in a better position to achieve the result. And most customers are willing to say, well, if you help put me in a better position, I'm going to go the rest of the way. If you're ever put in a position where you're guaranteeing a result that you don't have control over, boy, you better be pricing that really well. That is really pricing the unknown, but that's not what we're talking about here. So just wanted to back up and summarize why scoping tends to rise to the surface so quickly with hourly billing. It's still important with value pricing, because ultimately value pricing is a fixed price. We say this a lot. Every value price is a fixed price, but not every fixed price is a value price, right? Because you can do fixed pricing based on other things, such as estimating the hours, which is even increasing the risk more. So how do you get into scoping? Well, step one, you first have to identify the result. You have to identify that. And it needs to be not the result that you, the professional, think is important. It's the result the customer thinks is important. So you have to have a great conversation, a value conversation, or a why conversation with the customer to help determine what is the result that they're seeking and how can you understand their interpretation of that value. How is putting them in a position to achieve that result, helping them get there, how is that going to add value to their business, to their life, to their bottom line, to their quality of life, et cetera? You've got to put all of that on the table and have that conversation. Once you've done that, then you're in a position to go, okay, what are the various ways that we could possibly achieve that result? Because in most cases, there's more than one, right? I mean, let's talk about somebody who calls you up. It's, you know, early May 2018. So it's been almost a month since, you know, the dreaded April 15th tax day. So somebody calls you now and says, hey, I hadn't done anything. Okay. Well, step one, I can help you file an extension, right? Step two, I can help you file an extension and try to get your return ready for the deadline coming up, whether it's September, October. Step three, you know, we can actually go in and look at your previous tax returns and make sure they were filed correctly, because we might be able to, you know, I mean, you can keep going here, right? It's so easy for me to, or I think it's instinctive. Just like when you're billing by the hour, I think you instinctively go, you know, to the inputs and to the scope. With value pricing, I think it's equally as easy once you get into it to instinctively go toward options. How could we solve this problem? The example I use with a tax return, right? One is just a quick fix, right? One and done and you're out. And then you continue to evaluate that out. Even better when you're talking about scope is if you have one result and you go, well, are there more, is there more than one way to achieve that one result? The example I use was, you could argue in one sense it's the same result, but as I added options, kind of the result expanded, it got better. But is there more than one way to just achieve the same result? Ideally, what you want to do as a provider is you want to help the customer get there, not only in the fastest way possible, but also in the way that is going to have the most lasting impact. A lot of times, you know, I can put a Band-Aid on a broken bone and it'll help stop the bleeding for a little while, but ultimately that bone needs to be set and cast or put in a splint. So we want to take a look at those options. You also don't want to assume that the splint is better. You may have a customer who says, wrap that puppy in gauze. I've done that before and I'm happy with it. Now, you as the provider will have to go, okay, as a doctor, I'm not going to do that because I don't think that's sound medicine. But, you know, again, it's the customer's perception of value. So, again, the result's the first step, and we'll get more into breaking that down, but I just really want to make that point clear that that is step one.
Yeah, and you're right. Absolutely right. So, but there, I want to unpack some things because you covered a lot of ground, I think, with that. You talked about value pricing, all value pricing being fixed price, but not all fixed price being value priced. Okay. So it seems to me that the value pricing process is one thing, and the actual price you give the client or options of pricing, as you mentioned earlier, is another component. So we have to look at those two as separate components in the process of scoping the unknown. So we got discovering the value that the client gives to, you know, any specific results or a combination of results or how we get to that result, because some clients could value how we get to the results. One of the fundamental flaws of, you know, how some people present value pricing, in my opinion, and we can pick a fight if you want to, is that most people say, customer doesn't care how you get there as long as you get there. And that's what most people say. People don't care about what you do and how you do it. They only care about the results. And that's the general sentiment that the most value pricing people use to present value pricing. However, and I will take issue with that as being a complete statement. So I'm not saying I disagree with any of them. What I'm saying is that there are cases in which the how we get there, it's actually an important piece of the process, and it's actually the meat of the scope. So let me explain what I mean, okay? And let's talk about tax returns. So when a client comes to you and says, I want to hire you so you can prepare my tax return and have me pay the least amount of taxes I could possibly pay with my current situation. That's a very defined result, right? Pay the least amount of legal taxes according to my situation. So until you get the audit from the IRS, you really don't know whether you did pay the least amount of legal, right? Because you have to wait until the audit comes in to see if there's a change in the audit. So even with a very defined result like that, it is still dependent upon the professional to give his or her professional advice to say, this is the result you're asking for. This is, in my opinion, what the, you know, lowest legal amount of tax you need to pay. But what's interesting is you can actually go take the same amount of circumstances, take it to six different accountants, and you will probably get a variance on tax liability. And the reason for that is because every individual may have different criteria, and also every individual may have a different scope. And in tax, the scope, which is how we arrive to the number, it is significant. Let me explain what I mean. So when a client comes to you and tells you, this is my internally prepared financial statement. I had my $100,000 a year CFO that actually overlooked it, and he approves it and I approve it. Can you prepare my tax return using these numbers? Well, you know, the scope is very limited to getting numbers from the clients and being able to make maybe a couple of really high level adjustments because we're not getting deep into the numbers. But, and then I'll prepare the tax return and then the result is a result. But if the client comes to me and says, This is my internally prepared financial statement that my CFO looked at. However, I want to hire you to audit it, okay? And make any changes that you think that must be made. And, you know, today is November or whatever. And let me know what proactive things we can do in terms of making expenditures or whatever to have a different result, you know, during tax season. So the scope and the way we arrived to that number and when we were involved and what actions we took along the process significantly changed the number that drives that result. So the scope, which again, proverbially, it's the one thing that the clients don't care about. It's something that maybe is true, the client doesn't care about, but the scope could significantly affect how, you know, what the end result is at the end. I don't know if I'm explaining myself correctly, but what I want to just make sure that I mention is that, yes, it's true. Customers want a result and a result only. That's what they're paying for. That's correct. However, a customer may feel better or value more if the scope, if they're involved in the scope. You know what I mean? So to take it one step further, let's talk about the same exact tax return example. Let's say, for example, that it was the same thing, right? We are going to deliver a tax return and give them the lowest amount of legal tax liability they can pay under the circumstances. But the client says, on top of that, I would like you to document, you know, with you know, mild research, right? You know, give me the receipt, give me the date, give me the, you know, verify that the transaction went through before the end of the year, whatever, on every transaction over $10,000, just so I can have it together with my tax return, so I can feel a little bit better that doing an audit, at least the large transactions were reviewed by you before you prepare the tax return, right? So that's a different set of scope. Now we're still getting to the same result, but the scope is different. So I take issue with anyone that says no one cares about how you get to that number or how you get to the result, because in certain contexts it does. And how you get to the number also adds to not just the risk of the unknown, but also just the general risk of the professional. So I'll give you one more example using the same exact tax return situation. So if I audit the client's books, right, and then I prepare the tax return, and then they get an IRS audit, and then the IRS determines that there was a, you know, things were misprepared or misrepresented, I'm on the hook now because I audited and I charged for the audit, and part of my scope was to go through the details and determine whether or not the numbers were correctly represented. Whereas if the client came to me with the financial statements that they provide, that they certify, they're good to go, and they say, go ahead and prepare the tax return based on the numbers I give you, and they go through an IRS audit, and you know, while they dig in, they realize that there's a whole bunch of things that were misrepresented, I'm not in the hook because I didn't audit the specific books. It was the same result, an entirely different scope. So I want to give you some chance to answer that. Again, I'm not picking a fight. I'm just saying that in the real world, at least in my industry, scope matters a lot. You know, not just for us, but in some cases, the client, you know, does value more or less the details of the scope.
The reason the scope matters is because scope is intrinsically tied to result. And sometimes the result the customer is seeking, they may have a certain approach or a certain preference for how you get there. Okay. And I would say in most cases, that's not ideal. I guess it really boils down to who is doing the diagnosis and the prescription. If the customer is coming to you with a prescription they've already decided on and they will not let you diagnose, then that's a whole problem. And we've talked about that in previous episodes. You have to be able to do the diagnosis as a professional. Now, if the customer, let me give you an example. I mean, I, at least in the past, you know, to some people, they'll have a different response to this. But for me, tax-wise, I typically file an extension. And yes, I don't want to pay a whole lot more, but I've learned that the additional amount, if I don't pony up the money on April 15th, if I wait till June or July, whatever, it's marginal enough that it doesn't matter to me. Okay. It's marginal enough. It doesn't matter. And so you know, I let the accountant know, look, that's, yeah, I want to get it filed, but, you know, don't worry about, you know, the penalties and that kind of thing. And I've had to say that to my accountant before, look, I want to take 60 days to do this to the 30. The additional amount of penalty doesn't matter that much to me in the big scheme of things. It's not a big deal. You know, it's easier for me. Hey, I want to take this vacation, so we're going to stretch it out, whatever. Okay. So that's an example where accountant or bookkeeper don't necessarily assume that your customer thinks that paying the penalty is a bad idea. They might not, for various reasons. So that's an idea. But again, the reason customers, number one, try to dictate scope, in other words, how you do things, is number one, if you're billing by the hour, you're focusing on the inputs, and that instinctively leads you to scope. But another reason is because of the trust factor. The more they trust you, the more they see you have a history of getting these results, the more testimonials you have on your website, the more case studies you can provide, the better customer references, etc. In other words, the more you're perceived as the expert or the professional, which also leads into something we talked about recently about creating educational content through social media, blogs, podcasts, videos, etc. The more they perceive you as the expert, the more they trust you, the more they're going to be willing to give over to you the ability to lead them, to guide them, to be a Sherpa, as we talked about previously. It sounds like I'm just going to refer everybody to previous episodes. We are actually going to get to the new content, but this is so critical. The higher the trust factor, the more they perceive you as the expert, the more willingly they're going to allow you to do that. And so that all of this stuff comes into play. It's amazing how, you know, so many of the things we've talked about on previous shows are factoring into this. But let's get down to scoping, okay? So customer calls you, you have a value conversation with them, you have established the result they want, and they are willing to let you guide them. They are not going to, you know, be real particular about the scope. They're going to let you be the professional, be the consultant, and say, to achieve this result, the way to do it is this, and so you're going to be guiding the scope. Well, then you just need to make sure you've had a good value conversation with the customer. Again, it keeps going back. It's not like a broken record. To make sure that you thoroughly understand that value. And so one of the things I try to do in my process is make sure, even when I'm presenting the proposal, I have value statements in the proposal, and they're on the first page of the proposal, and I present the proposal to the customer. I don't just email it to them. Actually, we go through it in a GoToMeeting session, and I say, does that value sound right? And there are occasions where if I've got the value wrong, I stop right there. I say, you know what? We got this wrong. I need to go back to the drawing board. What I've got on the, you know, the scope and the price and schedule and all of that is irrelevant because I got the value wrong. I also do the same thing when it comes to scoping a project. I always keep the price and the schedule, the timeline, toward the end and on a separate page from the scope, so that I can feel free to talk about scope with the customer. They can see it. We can go back and forth. And if I realize at some point that the scope is out of whack, either I missed it, they want something else, they've changed their mind, they mentioned something I didn't cover, I need whatever, I'll say, look, I need to adjust this. So that's one of the first things you do in scoping the unknown is, well, you have some steps in the process to make sure you've got a chance to review the value and the scope with the customer and give them input. And one of those key critical steps after the value conversation is part of the proposal, building it and presenting it in a way that you can pause during the presentation and have that conversation so that that proposal step becomes more interactive.
So, Kirk, I'm just thinking about what you're saying, and I'm trying to listen attentively to see where we agree and where we just we still have a shift.
Where you're wrong.
Yeah, exactly where I'm wrong. So do you think scope and the end result are the same thing?
Oh, not at all. No, not at all. Uh-uh. The scope is the end. Okay. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. The result is the end. The scope is the means.
So the result is the what, and the scope is the how.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in does the customer care about the how? I mean, let's talk about that. Does the customer care about the how? And it could, this answer could be, it depends, right? Like, I think most people, when they go to the doctor and the doctor says, we're going to have to remove your spleen, you know, I don't think whether they use, you know, equipment A or equipment B or operating room that's this size or that size really matters to the patient. The patient will say, well, once my spleen is out, am I going to be okay, right? That's the what, and that's the result. So I think in many cases, the scope or the process or the how doesn't matter, just because the other person doesn't have the cognitive capacity to even have an opinion about the scope, right? However, if a plumber comes to your house and I don't know, you have some sort of leak, and they tell you, I'm going to fix the leak no matter what, and there may be some consequences, you know, that I don't want to talk about now until we figure out what happens, but there's some possible consequences, and don't worry about it. That doesn't really work really well, right? People say, wait a second, are you going to break something else? You know, are you going to cause issues, you know, while you're doing this? So I think that the how, although it doesn't matter to most people, which is pretty much the scope, tends to matter in some context. So is there a way to understand, I guess, whether or not that how matters to the customer and whether or not that how plays into the value, well, in this case, not the result specifically, because we're still thinking the result is independent from the scope and the process and the how, right? But assuming that the result is the same, is the how the options? I guess that's maybe my question. Is the how the options, or is the result the options, or is it a mixture of the two?
Ideally, the options are going to be either different scopes to get to the same result, or more likely and most commonly, expanded scopes that have expanded results. Now, sometimes the result could sometimes the difference could be as simple as how fast you do it. I mean, I've literally put together proposals where the lowest option was something that took, you know, 6 months, and the middle option was something that took 3.5. And the only difference was the amount of time.
So, like, you know, you get your oil changed in a 1 hour place versus a place that takes half a day, the same oil change. The how, it's probably the same, but there was one little change in the how, which is, I guess, timing, that caused the issue. So is that what you're saying?
Yes. And, you know, to get to one of the key tools in the vocabulary of value pricing that we use when putting together options are the 7 T's. And I'm not going to list those and go into them right now, except to say that timing is one of them. It's one of the 7 categories or factors we look at when putting together options. And so timing is one of the most common. It's also, by the way, one that I think is easily overlooked by professionals. I think payment terms is the other one. Those two are huge. Those two things alone can create options using those two very easily. And it might be the same result for all three, quote unquote, the same end result. But because timing is factored into it, then, you know, how quickly they get the result is part of the result, right? Or whether they have to pay all up front or it's spread out. Those are also factors. And by the way, they're factors because of how it affects the customer's perception. In other words, the customer might value something they get quicker, higher. By the way, I've made this mistake before. I've made the mistake of assuming if the customer gets it faster, it's worth more to them. Not always the case. You've got to explore that. So as we get into scoping the unknown, I mean, your title of this was, you know, how to deal with scoping and how to handle the unknown. I think, you know, I actually looked this up when you were kind of doing your opening introduction to this episode. You know, you hear the term known unknowns, unknown knowns, and unknown unknowns. And all that phrase comes from Donald Rumsfeld when he was, you know, Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush. And I'm not going to get into that except to say that there are things you know that are going to happen. There are things that might happen that you are aware they might happen or they might not. And then there are things you can't foresee. And so when we're writing scope, what we typically want to be able to cover are the known knowns and the known unknowns. And then we want to make sure that we have addressed the agreement with the customer in a way that when an unknown comes up, we know how to handle it. And there's going to be probably one of two ways to handle an unknown unknown. It's either you as the professional have priced it and scoped it such that you're willing to do that because you got paid incredibly well. And I'll give an example of this to kind of illustrate. Or more than likely, you have a conversation with the customer, hey, this is out of scope. And so, do you want to pursue this? I'd be happy to put together a change request for you with the new scope and the new price, but it's outside scope. And that puts the burden on us again as a professional to, put our hand up and say, hey, this is out of scope. Sometimes we're scared to do that and we can't be scared of it. We've actually got to realize that that's actually part of the service we provide to the customer. The metaphor that I want to use goes back to one of my Verisage colleagues, Chris Marsden. It's a concentric circle metaphor. And Chris Marsden is a lawyer who deals in corporate litigation and extremely complex corporate financial structures. And yet he does it all on a fixed price basis and has since he opened his law firm, over a decade ago. Yeah, there you are drawing an example of it, I think. But yeah, or that's Ron's book, right? It comes from Ron's book, and Ron, gives the credit for this to Chris Marsden. Chris draws circles. He'll do this on a legal pad. I've seen him do it on a whiteboard, but he'll do, imagine four concentric circles. The inner circle is the yes work. These are the things we know we've got to do, right? We have to file an extension with the IRS. We know we've got to do that, okay? Then you get into the likely work. Well, what's the likely work? Well, the likely work's probably that we're also going to need to file a tax return by, the extended deadline. Then you get into maybe work. Well, what's maybe work? Well, if this customer's in a high risk, there could be an opportunity that once we file it, the IRS may send us a letter, say, hey, we need you to document this better. We need some supporting materials. We're not auditing you, but we are asking you to back it up. Okay, something like that. So it's not a full-blown audit. It's just, hey, send us a little more paperwork so we can, sign on the dotted line here. And then, so you get three concentric circles, which most of us should be comfortable, and you can write proposals based around yes work, likely work, maybe work. But then you get into the outer circle, which is basically everything else, which Chris affectionately calls who the hell knows. Okay? And there is a price where with this customer or this type of thing, we will cover who the hell knows. Now, by the way, who the hell knows is going to be an extremely expensive price. Why? Because when you are pricing who the hell knows work, what you're really selling is an insurance policy. You are writing a premium and the customer is paying for the premium. You both are agreeing that you will take on the risk of who the hell knows. And that's really what the conversation with the customer should be about when you're talking about these areas of work. Yes, likely, maybe, who the hell knows, is what level of risk are they comfortable with? And Chris says most of the time he will offer who the hell knows, not all the time, but he'll offer, frequently. But most of the time, customers don't pick it, but occasionally they do. And I think Chris says most of the, of the times when he's offered who the hell knows, most of the time, it's just extra profit in his pocket, which is what most insurance companies do with our premiums, right? The number of people that actually have a home fire or, other type of traumatic, damage to their home that's significant. I mean, I've had a water leak. I've had a hot water tank burst. That's a five-figure deal, usually, low to mid five figures, but that's not the huge risk the insurance company's taking on. They're used to those kind of claims, and those kind of claims are routine. It's when the house burns down, the house is worth $500,000. Now all of a sudden it's a much bigger claim, right? That's, you're totally having to replace your house. That's the who the hell knows part the insurance company's doing. And so if we're going to get into that area, we've got to become actuaries. Actuaries are incredibly smart people that don't generally have really good communication skills because they're kind of math nerds. They know statistics and probability and all that incredibly well. But that's essentially what we're doing. So this again gets back to why we tie price to scope, because scope is tied to result and result is tied to risk. It all factors in.
Yeah, that was awesome, Kirk. That was great that you actually segued to that, because while you were talking during this whole episode, I was going through the book, Implementing Value Pricing by Ron Baker, and I was trying to find the page that had that because I wanted to make sure that we at least cover that, because I would probably say the most emblematic part of this entire conversation when it comes to pricing the unknowns or scoping the unknowns or both, because they're pretty much the same thing, is Chris Marston's concentric circles. So when I read this about 4 years ago, I glanced right through it. I didn't even understand what it was saying as a bunch of circles. Yes, no, who the hell knows? I just completely went through it. I didn't even understand the power of this. And then when I heard someone else explain it, with their own voice, it finally clicked in, and it was an incredible mind shift change for me. Because I was able to, because now I actually understood how to use this tool. So let me, in 5 minutes, let me try to show you a real example of how I use this tool. So we come into a client that says, Hector, I want to hire you to help me implement QuickBooks in my business. This is probably the most common thing that I do. But the client said, I want you to give me one price, no hourly rates, no surprises. And within a determined amount of time, you tell me what that is as a professional. I need you to walk out of here and us feel like we have everything under control with our new ERP system, our new accounting system. That's what I call a complex project. The reason why the project is complex is because the expectation of the client is still unknown at this point. They did give us a really big hint, which is by the time you're done, you're out, we're in, right? That's called a turnkey project. And turnkey projects have so much risk associated with it because your reputation is on the line. Because at the end, you could walk out and say, screw you, you guys messed up the scope. And this is how a lot of turnkey projects end up with a non-amicable separation, because turnkey projects are extremely difficult to scope. And most of the time, the problem is price, not scope. Because even if you got the scope wrong, but you priced it as potentially three times the scope, you're probably okay with just adding more resources and just getting it done, assuming you have the capacity to do it, right? So let me tell you how I used it. So we have the four circles you mentioned: yes, likely, maybe, who the hell knows. So what you do is, it's just real simple. The most impressive thing you can do with a client is walk him through the process of what you know, what he knows, or he or she knows, what you guys learn by talking together, and what you may learn deeper in the project on the first meeting or the second meeting if you start writing things down. So we'll start with yes work. Yes work, as you said, is everything that we know for a fact to be true. So we know that you're currently on Peachtree. We know that you have 6 employees. We know that 2 of them are very comfortable with the software. 4 of them have no clue. We know that you have 1 person in a physical remote location that we may have to do some training remotely or connect them remotely. We know that the CFO is anal about details in the chart of accounts. So you start writing down what you know, and you sit down with the customer and say, what do we know? Let's write everything that we know down, because the best way to price and scope the unknown is to at least get out of the way what you do know, right? Because that makes it easier to just figure out what you don't. Because it's funny, most of the stuff you don't know, you actually know it. You just don't go through the exercise to figure out whether you know it or not. And many a times, it's just a matter of asking, is this important to you? Yes, no, okay, now we know it, right? Because the unknown typically is what could go wrong or what the customer could have in their head in terms of expectations. So we write down everything that we do know for a fact, everything that is a variable that affects the price, that affects the scope. And that is, and that you time that times 100%. Then we go to likely work. So you are going to write down all the things that have a probability of more than 50%, but you don't know 100% it's going to happen, but you do know it's likely. In legal terms, likely means 51% or more, or over 50%, right? Then you list those out. These are all the things that we were likely to do, but it's not set in stone. So it is safe to say that maybe about half of those will show up. Then we go to the maybe work, which is the stuff that look, I've seen it happen before. It's not common. It's definitely not 50% plus. You could probably assign 25% of that. So you list all the things that maybe, right? Maybe could happen. And you assign a 25% to that. And then the last one, the who the hell knows, this is all the catastrophic events, all the things that no one can foresee. And there's no way you can write them all down. But if you have experience, you can write down at least 3 or 4 of all the catastrophic situations you had in the past, of things that were, it wasn't possible to foresee. You would have to spend 6 months scoping the client to be able to possibly foresee it. And even then, no one can tell the future. So you write down maybe 2 or 3 or 5 catastrophic situations, right? We get an audit and you get a $50,000 penalty. That's catastrophic. Or we don't file on time and that's, you know, you get a huge penalty. That's catastrophic. Or the client was laundering money, and that's catastrophic to me as the accountant, because now I have to depose, you know, in court or something like that. So all these are all the possible things, they're possible, but very remote possible. And maybe you assign a 10% to that. Then you come in and you actually assign a price to everything that you wrote down, the stuff that's going to happen for sure, the likely, the maybe, and the catastrophic. You assign a price to that and you multiply it times the probability that it will happen. And that's how you arrive to a price. And if you do that with the client has a huge realization that you, number one, you don't know what's going to happen, but you have a pretty good idea and grasp about the possibilities that it could happen. You also have a good probability and grasp of what it would cost if something like that we don't know would happen. And you also have an extremely fair way of pricing it, because you're multiplying it times using mathematics, and people love mathematics. When you multiply things by a percentage, people are very impressed because it sounds official. So when you do all that, the client gets, you know, really intimate into your process of understanding what are the things that could go right, that could go wrong, what you know, what you don't know. And that's probably the best way to start a conversation with the client on pricing the unknown. You could also do this on your own behind the scenes, but I believe it's much more powerful, like you said, drawing it on a piece of paper or on a whiteboard and listing it out and multiplying it actuarially with a percentage based on probability. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because that's a tool that I actually have used, and it has helped a lot in at least, you know, build a bond with the client around the fact that, hey, we're both in this together. We both in the unknown. We both don't know what's going to happen. And if you want to go in this journey together, we're going to have to share that risk.
So we're coming up on the end of our episode for this week, but I'm going to suggest that we continue part 2 for next week, because there's several other things under this topic that we can talk about. One being the idea of doing a discovery engagement. If it feels like everything is an unknown at the beginning, how can you use that as a tool? The idea is, you and I kind of started to elaborate on, but didn't get the full detail of, how can you actually demonstrate your expertise with the customer by talking through these things? Sometimes just by going through, hey, this could happen, this probably won't happen, you know, kind of having that actuarial or that risk assessment discussion with the customer, it makes them reassured that you're kind of on top of things, right? Having that and realizing that not only does it have the benefit of building your trust, but it also has the benefit of allowing you to increase your price as you move further out on the concentric circles model. We also haven't talked anything about change management, which ultimately that, you know, can come into play. But so far, everything we talked about is, you know, upfront proposal scoping. And by the way, the reason projects go off the rail a lot of times is due to lack of either experience or follow through on scoping. And by the way, that's one of the biggest perceived risks when moving from hourly to value, is somebody's going to eat my lunch because I'm horrible at scoping. The good news is you get better pretty darn quick when your tail is on the line.
That's right. So it's I think it sends a really strong signal to the client about the value you bring to the table when you are diligent on scope. When you price by the hour, that means that, you know what, the scope is open, anything can happen. And if it does happen, you as a customer will take the entire risk. So, you know, I think just for the mere sake of being different, being better than your competition, standing out, even if your proposal is 10 times the price of the next guy, which, by the way, mine was, it was 5 times the price. But
good for you.
Yeah. And, you know, but the client was willing to pay for that certainty, which it wasn't really a certainty, but it was, at least it's the illusion of certainty, because you wrote it down, because you planned it, because you stated a percentage of probability. And believe it or not, that's sometimes all what people want. All people want is, look, if I'm going to give you money, I just want you to have your stuff together. And that's it. And a good, strong, thorough scope sends a very strong signal of that.
Well, it's obvious we were going to have trouble putting the brakes on this conversation. So, Hector, let's continue it in part 2 next week.
All right, Kirk. See you next week.
Bye.